This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Classic LNL, beloved listeners. You've probably heard in the news that the legendary East German spy master Marcus Wolf has kicked the bucket at the age of 83. I mention this because back in July 1997, I was joined on the program by Marcus Wolf and writers John Banville and Philip Knightley for this discussion on espionage. If you have a security clearance, you are free to listen. Good evening, Gladys, one and all, and welcome to the best of Late Night Live. And I hope you've got a security clearance, because tonight our topic is espionage. The following broadcast will be written entirely in vinegar, and to make it clear, you'll have to hold it up to a candle. Now, if you thought that with the end of the Cold War, the fine tradition of espionage might have had its day, then you were wrong. This year, we've seen NATO expand its membership to include Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Apparently, Western intelligence agencies have decided that NATO secrets may no longer be safe in the hands of former Eastern Bloc countries. Thus, more spies are called for to spy on their new colleagues. And many of them, of course, used to work for the KGB. Now, a few months ago, MI5 surprised everyone by advertising for trainee spies in The Guardian. Scouts on it, cross my heart. It's a newspaper well read, of course, by budding James Bonds and probably by budding Kim Philbys as well. What all this seems to suggest is that espionage is on the increase. Good news for all those caught up with the supposed glamour of spying. Now, a number of the happy MI5 applicants will be disappointed to find themselves crunching numbers on a computer in suburban Kent instead of crunching foreign agents in exotic parts of the world. It's funny, isn't it, how spying has been so successfully portrayed as thrilling, risky, even erotic, when the reality is that spies are often reviled for the work they do. Now, last year we explored some of these concepts and concerns with a very impressive panel. We were joined from Dublin by John Banville, literary editor of the Irish Times and author of 10 important novels, most recently The Untouchable, a fictionalised account of the life of Sir Anthony Blunt. You'll recall that Blunt was disgraced in the late 70s when he was publicly unmasked as the fifth man in the Philby MacLean treason case. Now, we're also joined by Philip Knightley, journalist and author of many books on espionage, including a biography of Kim Philby titled Philby, The Life and Views of the KGB Master Spy. And finally, and almost spectacularly, we were able to unearth in Berlin Marcus Wolf, the former head of the foreign intelligence arm of Stasi, a post he held for 34 years. Now, during the Cold War, Wolf was known as the man without a face, because Western authorities had no idea what he looked like. Well, today, however, his face is very well known, and last year he published his autobiography, Man Without a Face, the autobiography of communism's greatest spy master. And Marcus Wolf is certainly not a man without an ego. I firstly sought his views on whether Western countries were correct to worry about former Soviet bloc countries being privy to NATO secrets.
I think not. I think it's not correct, because the greatest part of history of the successful Soviet or Russian intelligence services are gone. They passed, and perhaps there may be some connections until now, but I think they are not too big and not too serious.
Marcus, as the ruins of the Soviet Union smoulder, isn't there a possibility that freelancers could gain this information and simply sell it on to the highest bidder?
Yes, of course it's possible. But I think now the situation of Russia and of the services too is not sure enough, and I think every agent, where he will be in the world, will be very careful to go in contact or to give big information. Of course, the power game continues, of course, and as long as this game will continue, the services in East and in West will continue their work.
Marcus, after a lifetime in the business, you now say you're skeptical of the value of espionage. But looking back, what contribution does East Germany's intelligence make to the goings on in the Cold War? Did it, for example, play a major role in maintaining the peace?
I think yes, because the intelligence services and my service too contributed to a half century of peace, the longest Europe has ever known, by giving the statesmen some security that they would not be surprised. And this is a contribute, perhaps, to the peace, how big it could be. Of course, the balance of power of the atomic weapons played the main role. But I think the services had a part of this contribution, too.
In essence, by removing the element of surprise from both sides.
Yes, I think so.
Mm. Now, in your book, Marcus, you've written, what makes an espionage service efficient depends much more on the willingness of those who receive its information to pay attention to when it contradicts their own opinions. Now, tolerating dissent and contradiction weren't the best qualities of your former leaders. How did you handle these situations when you knew that the bosses wouldn't like what you wanted to tell them, that the messenger might be blamed for the message?
Yes, it was perhaps the most difficult part in my work to manage this. It was very, very difficult because the way of the information were directed by decisions, in my case by the decision of my minister, and in his hands were the most important information. The only way I had was to give it to Moscow too. And in one of the most interesting parts of the post-war work in my part, when Willy Brandt, the chancellor, the social democrat chancellor, started his new East policy, perhaps this way of information through Moscow helped to play a role to understand that this is a new kind of policy of understanding, of detente. And I think the information we gave that time to Moscow played a bigger role as the information we gave to our own political leaders.
Marcus, I remember that you had a mole working for Willy Brandt, and in fact the revelation of this played a major part in Brandt's fall. Do you now regret this?
No, I think if I would say so, you perhaps will not believe, and you will be right. Of course, I regret that the mole, you mean Günter Guillaume, gave a preface for the retirement of Willy Brandt. But I think every head of intelligence service has a dream to go in such a top position in the government of the from the other side.
Yes, you'll probably get extra frequent flyer points for that. Philip, would you be kind enough to explain to the Antipodean listener the distinctions between a mole, an agent, and a spy?
Well, a man who's employed by an intelligence agency is usually known as an officer, and he works directly to the head of his department and is a professional spy. An agent is somebody that professional spy hires to do the dirty work for him. The professional spy usually has diplomatic immunity. Nothing's likely to happen to him if he's caught. He'll just be expelled, as we've seen on many occasions in Australia, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union. The mole is an intelligence officer who has been planted, not under diplomatic cover, in the enemy country to pretend that he is an ordinary citizen of that country and uncover and reveal information to his superiors. That's basically it. Now, there's a lot of subdivisions of that. There are agents who are so-called agents of influence, who are usually people that serving an intelligence officer has met at a party, and in order to ingratiate himself with his superiors back in the capital, he says, "I met so-and-so, I met Philip Knightley last night at a party. He is sympathetic to our cause, and I'm planning to recruit him as an agent of influence."
Yes, well, that accusation, of course, was made about the Australian historian, the late Manning Clark, recently, and caused a huge kerfuffle here. Yeah.
Sure, exactly. So a lot of people who have no reason to believe that their names are in the files of an enemy intelligence agency would be surprised to find they are, because they accidentally met somebody, a serving intelligence officer at a party or a social function, and to inflate his importance with his boss, he put them down as a possible contact.
Philip, I've mentioned your line about espionage being the second oldest profession. Have your researchers, how far back in history have your researchers taken it? Has it always been a part of the workings of a country, of a city-state?
Well, there are spies have been around, of course, since biblical times, and were very active, in, for example, in Elizabethan Britain. But the spy is an organized part of government, an intelligence service. A government department staffed by bureaucrats is only comparatively recent, only this century. Started in Britain in 1911, and then sort of grew out of control all over the world. People don't realize, for example, the CIA only got started 50 years ago this week, 1947, July the 26th, 1947. And its motto at that time, a small little agency, which its future director, Alan Dulles, said will never be more than about 20 people with a very small budget, just to keep government informed about what's happening around the world. But secretly, in the back in the corridors of the CIA, they were already saying bigger than state by 48. And by 1948, they're indeed bigger than the State Department. They grew from that 20 people to, at the end of the Cold War, they had 19,000 employees and a budget of $9 billion.
I want to talk to John in a minute about what motivates, or the complexities of the motivation behind the activities of a guy like Blunt. But before we get on to that, Philip, you see a new wave of spies, and I understand you regard Aldrich Ames as a part of this new wave. He's the guy that sold the Soviet the names of U.S. agents for a great deal of money.
Yeah, I think what's happened is that all the spies all around the world are not prepared to admit that the game's over, boys. It's full time and nobody won. We may have won the Cold War, but in the espionage war, the demise of the Soviet Union and the KGB has also meant the imminent demise of the CIA. We're seeing it collapsing all around us. The CIA's had five directors in the past 7 years. Even its own officers are saying the end of the Cold War has meant the end of the CIA. So they're looking around for other means of continuing this very comfortable, flourishing lifestyle that they all had, authorized sex, good holidays, unaccountable expenses, you know, the sort of things that journalists and radio broadcasters often have. And they thought, well, what can we do now? And they're very easily recruited for money because the ideology has gone out of it. Cash is the big thing these days.
Well, let's put the ideology back into it by introducing John Banville. Now, John, in his book, Marcus talks about the feeling of belonging to a special community, an elite, a secretive club fighting for a noble ideal that was of particular importance to many Westerners from upper middle-class backgrounds. Can we extrapolate from that and look into the fictional character of this Victor Maskell, who, of course, is derives from Anthony Blunt?
Yes, well, I mean, one of the things that attracted me to the character of Blunt, and indeed to the circle of the Cambridge spies, was envy of the lives that they had. I mean, they had a whale of a time. And I think this is part of the fascination that we all have, that we feel for the Cambridge spies. They were sort of the flower of their generation. They were upper middle class, quite well off, extremely well educated. They had as much experience of life, champagne, sex, art, as one can possibly expect in one life. And they also had this very serious side as well, this serious secret side. And one of the things that prompts my book is this fact that they can say, well, we may seem terribly dandyish and unserious as we sort of rag about and drink our champagne and have our parties and so on. This is especially in the 1930s. But what you don't know about me is that behind all that, there is a very serious, very rigorous life being led. And as Aristotle says, the man with a secret is the man with power. To have that kind of secret power is must have been intoxicating.
You write that it's hard to recapture now the heady flavour of those pre-war days when the world was going to hell with bells banging and whistles madly shrilling. Perhaps you can evoke them a little more for us.
Well, they... I suppose the most serious of them was Guy Burgess, although, ironically, he was the most raucous and the most seemingly... I mean, he seemed to be a drunk. He seemed to be merely a drunk and merely a very active homosexual. But in fact, I suppose ideologically, he was the soundest of them all. But he used to go about, especially towards the end of his career as a spy, he used to go about telling people that he was a Russian spy. And they would all laugh and say, my goodness, what a coward old guy is, you know, pretending that he's a spy, but all the time that he was a spy. So that there was a sense in which these people were laughing at the world from behind their masks, not always maliciously. I don't see them as terribly wicked people, I'm afraid. And it's been interesting to read the reviews of my book. The people who regard the Cambridge spies as the most appalling traitors that Britain has had in this century take the portrait that I have done of Maskell, of the blunt figure, as an indictment of this dreadful man. People who think that the Cambridge spies were really quite interesting, at the very least, regard Maskell as a very sympathetic character, so that it's almost as if there are two books, depending on the way that you...
Well, that's considerate to your credit, isn't it? Because it is so morally complex. It is it's so full of paradox. I mean, here were people who knew what they were doing and, more importantly, why. And that sets them apart, does it not, from many of their generation?
Yes, well, I wonder. You see, in a way, I feel a bit of a fraud appearing on this programme with two... such experts on espionage, because, of course, what I've written is fiction, and fiction is without conscience in the way that it plunders the world and plunders people's lives for its material. I wanted to write a book about our obsessional search for authenticity in this century. I think that the strongest thing that we feel at the moment is a sense of our inauthenticity, and to find something real, to find a solid ground to stand on is an obsession, has been an obsession of ours, certainly since the end of the First World War. But I set out to write the book as a kind of anti-spy novel, anti-thriller. My characters are more farcical than serious or frightening or thrilling. They're spying... is largely concerned with trivia. And if you go back and look at people like Blunt or Graham Greene, who did a little bit of spying on the side, they always insisted afterwards, as Marcus Wolf has to some extent at the start of your programme, said that they weren't terribly effective. I feel that of the Cambridge spies, the only really effective one was Donald MacLean, who was instrumental in passing a lot of the information on the hydrogen bomb to Russia. And that was a very significant thing indeed. But other than that, I suspect that it was playing this extraordinarily incestuous game that both sides played, or the many sides played.
John, forgive my ignorance.
I think it was fun.
Yeah. Well, I think you capture that enormously. Forgive my ignorance, but was Blunt Irish? Because you've made your Blunt Irish.
Well,
you've just been mischievous.
That's what I said about the novelist having absolutely no conscience. No, what I did was I decided that I was going to have to do this impersonation of this character because the novel is written in the first person. And I felt that I would have to make him an Irishman because I, along with pretending to be his age and his class and his education and his expertise, I didn't want to have to pretend to be English as well. So I made him Irish. And I remembered that Anthony Blunt, when he was at school at Marlborough, his best friend was Louis MacNeice, the poet, by Fine, underestimated Northern Irish poet. And I was reading, Anthony Blunt, of course, was an expert on the paintings of Poussin, and I took down a selected collection of Raymond Nice's poetry, and the first poem in the book was called Poussin. And I thought that this was Louis sending me a message from
synchronicity, from
saying, "All right, you can take my life." So I made my Blunt figure into an Irishman because, of course, as an Irishman, I have a very ambiguous attitude toward England.
Yes, one can take that as well.
Well, I wanted Maskell to be, as well as being a spy, I wanted him to be one of these people who, like George Bernard Shaw or Oscar Wilde, Irishmen who went to England and became more English than the English themselves, while at the same time being sort of court jesters. So that this gives him another extension, another secret life.
You're listening to Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, via ABC Online and Pod, and this program on espionage was first broadcast in July 1997. My guests were writer John Banville, literary editor of the Irish Times, Marcus Wolff, the former head of the foreign intelligence arm of the East German Stasi, and journalist and author Philip Knightley. You'll have to break the code. We had to do the whole thing in code, obviously. Now, Philip, you were the fortunate journalist sent to Sir Anthony Blunt's flat, charged with delivering a letter advising him that his name was connected to Philby as a possible KGB agent. This was as a result of an ongoing work of investigative journalism. Can you tell the listener what his response was?
Yes, I rang the doorbell at East Grayson Favour flat in the Courthold Institute, and after a while this heavy door swung open, creaking on its hinges, and there stood Sir Anthony, an imposing figure, tall, black trousers, crimson spattered dinner jacket, or was it a smoking jacket? I forget which. And black slippers. And he looked at me and I said, "Sir Anthony Blunt," and he nodded. And I passed him this letter that said we would like to interview him about his possible role in the whole Philby and the other spies affair. He read the letter very carefully, and then he firmly shut the door in my face. So we didn't exchange one word.
And, of course, the next day you got the lawyer's letter, didn't you?
Yes, saying if Knight never appears at my flat again, uninvited, I'll call the police.
It was Thatcher's decision to politically out Blunt as a spy 15 years after he'd confessed and received immunity from prosecution. And I understand that many in the trade see this as a big mistake. Was it?
Yes, absolutely. It was a big mistake. Sir Dick White, former head of SIS, told me that he considered one of the most important errors that the Thatcher government made, and Lord knows they made enough. He said that they, by doing that, they ruined any possibility of ever persuading another spy to accept immunity from prosecution in return for collaboration, because it became clear that the British government would not necessarily keep its word.
It's interesting that the House of Windsor, of course, kept mum on it, but there's a marvellous theory about that Blunt was sent on a wartime mission into Germany to retrieve some very embarrassing letters for the family that the Duke had written while he was still in England, which would, of course, demonstrate it all. Proven beyond any reasonable doubt his pro-Nazi views. Is that real? Is this a true story?
That is real, yes. That is a true story. The cover story put out by Buckingham Palace that these letters were from Queen Victoria to somebody, one of her German relatives, and that they didn't want them to fall into the hands of some GI who would sell them to Vanity Fair or some other American publication. So that they had to be rescued to prevent embarrassment to the royal family. But of course what they consisted largely of was letters from the Duke of Windsor to his various Nazi pals in Germany, which would have been even more embarrassing should they have come out. And don't forget, of course, another reason for the Queen's ambivalent attitude towards Blunt. Not only was he her second cousin once removed and keeper of her pictures, but there were a lot of people in Britain who felt, well, what has he done that's really so wrong? Don't forget at the time that he was most active in his spying for the KGB. It was during the war when Russia, the Soviet Union, was an ally. He was passing on information that helped the Russians on the Eastern Front eventually defeat the Germans. And a lot of people thought that information should have been more freely available anyway. So what was his great crime at a time when little old ladies up and down the United Kingdom were knitting socks for Russian soldiers, and the sword of Stalingrad toured Britain to great acclaim from the English working classes.
What's your view on that, Philip?
Well, my view is I think that he was a greatly maligned man. The only service he performed after the Cold War had started was to help Burgess get out of the country, and Burgess probably could have managed that quite well himself anyway.
And 4 years later, he dies alone and dishonoured.
Yes, a rather sad story all over.
Marcus, many people have been waiting for you to recant your political beliefs and your espionage work, that with the fall of communism, you should now admit that all your work was for nothing. I understand that you don't recant your faith in Marxism, but how do you respond to these critics?
Yes, please come back once more to the question, why? You asked why. I met some time, of course, when they lived in Moscow, Kim Philby in Berlin, he came, George Blake too, and Ruth Werner, or better known and described in Philip Knightley's book as Ruth Kuczynski, who worked for the Soviet military intelligence in England too. She was recruited by Richard Sorge. We have very close relations. I think no of them felt themselves as traitors or spies. We had another word in German. We use the word Kundschafter. We never use the word spy or agent. Kundschafter, I don't know how to translate, maybe something like scouts. They were very honorable people for us. And this examples of such people from the time before and during the World War II helped us to educate our young officers, to give him such a conviction to do a good thing for a grand cause, if you want.
Well, Marcus, you still have that conviction, don't you?
Yes, I have it, but of course for the intelligence services, I think this time passed. It's gone away. The ideological, and I think Philip Knightley thinks the same, is not now the most important part of recruiting of spies or agents. It was a great time of espionage, the greatest time for the Soviet intelligence was before and during the World War II, not after. And I think one part of our successes of service, what I lead, was our ability to use this kind of examples. Our best sources we had worked out of conviction, not under pressure, not because of money. Of course, we had important agents who worked for money. One of the examples I describe in my book is Klaus Kuron, responsible and as the head of counterintelligence for the work against my service. It was a bit laughable for us because we knew all cards of our advisories.
Last year in Berlin, Marcus, I was talking to Stefan Heim, who made the point that the communist role in East Germany could have been reformed and allowed to survive. That's pretty much your position, isn't it?
Yes, it's looking from now, he's right, of course. We hoped that there will be a possibility to reform our system in a democratic way, a socialist democratic state. But looking from now, it was impossible without reforms from Moscow, coming from Moscow. But Perestroika and Glasnost with Gorbachev came too late, too. The time was over. The big hope which came with the Russian Revolution in 1917 was not fulfilled. It passed, and it will need, I think, a long time if such an utopia will come again. I'm sure they will come again, but now it's destroyed for a long time.
We're having a crash course in espionage tonight, dear listeners, and I should remind you that you're hearing the voices of Marcus Wolff, communism's master spy. and Philip Knightley, of course, and the Irish novelist John Banville. Now, Marcus, you were approached by the West Germans. They offered you freedom from prosecution, then by the Americans, who offered you $1 million and a house in California if you would hand over the names of East German and Russian agents. Why did you decline these blandishments? Why did you refuse to do so?
It is a question of my whole life, of the conviction of my parents, the education I got from my parents in the Soviet Union too, and I asked all former officers of my service not to become traitors of their conviction, not to betray persons who worked for them by out of conviction, the majority of them. It was a question of conviction.
You realize, of course, that many people don't regard it as fair that you've escaped when many junior border guards were tried and sentenced for obeying orders to shoot. And even the former East German leader, Honecker, spent time in jail before facing 49 counts of manslaughter and embezzlement.
Yes, it was a question following of the policy, but I found it not fair to do it against only one part of the leaders of one state, because it was the responsibility of the community of all socialist countries, the Soviet Union ahead, and therefore it was a question of revenge to bring the leaders of the other country to a trial. Of course, every dead people, even on the border or on another part, is too much. I think there is a line where which is not to be crossed even by the intelligence services. This is a human life.
I know that John Banville has said that he feels uneasy in the company of a couple of professionals in the trade, but, John, the fact of the matter is that you bring to the story of Blunt, you bring to the issue of spying, the novelist's ability to conject on psychological motivations. And this is often missing, I think, in some of the more classic texts. So I want to go back to you and talk to you about your book as an essay on Englishness. Now, we've pointed out that we've got this Irishman who observes the English as a perverse, stubborn, absurd and sly nation. At the same time, he revels in his English traits, his superiority, pomposity and position. But he feels, and I think this is the interesting part, a deep sense of isolation from others. Do you think that this state of superior, of isolation, contributes to his ability to be a spy and to maintain those different lives?
Yes, I mean, it's something of a cliché now to point out that the art of espionage and the art of fiction are really quite alike in many ways. I mean, the novelist exists within society as a kind of spy. He's constantly watching other people's behaviour. There is one moment at which Maskell, speaking about, I suppose, the only real villain in the book, Quirrell, English novelist, he says that Quirrell had real interest in other people, which was always the mark of the second-rate novelist. I think that the way in which Maskell looks at the world is that he wants to absorb the world into himself. He wants to contain it all. He doesn't want to be in the power of anybody, and being in someone's power, of course, is to be loved by them, or to love, even worse, to love them, so that he avoids love, and he doesn't quite know how it works. But he knows how knowledge works, and he knows the kind of weight that knowledge gives to a human being, the way in which it knowledge tethers him to a world which he feels, which he knows, is quaking under his feet. So he's, as I said before, Maskell, as I think great many spies do, is searching for authenticity. One can hear it when Marcus Wolff talks about his convictions, about his upbringing, about his parents, that Marxism for him and his work in Marxism were ways of tethering him, of holding him, of giving him weight and giving him authenticity. And I feel that this is true. Certainly it's true of Maskell. I believe it was true of Blunt. I believe it was true of all the Cambridge spies, that they saw espionage as a way of giving themselves some weight and some authenticity in the world.
Philip Knightley, does this sound right to you with what you know about these characters?
Yes, that rings a bell with me, a very strong bell. I think that when they had the opportunity to do what they did, they wanted to serve in some capacity, and they were told, don't go off and die as a young volunteer in the Spanish Civil War. There are much more important things with your intellect and ability that you can contribute to the cause. And I think that they, by making that strong personal commitment, that strong political commitment, they were prepared to carry it through for the rest of their lives. The only real contempt that Philby ever seemed to have for anybody was somebody who had a political conviction and then lost it and become a turncoat. So, he was contemptuous of Muggeridge, and he was contemptuous of Koestler, who he felt had done the right thing to begin with, but then had lost their way somehow. And that they all received from the life that they chose a reward in the sense that they knew what they were doing and they knew where they were going and they had something to work for. That sort of feeling that is so missing in contemporary society.
John Banville, I want to ask you...
Sorry, Marcus.
We should also...
Sorry to interrupt you. I was thinking as Philip was speaking that as an Irishman, I've always been fascinated by the concept of the English gentleman. This is an absolute judgment that the English make about themselves and about each other. One is either a gentleman or one isn't. And the Cambridge spies were, of course, gentlemen. They didn't make any money from this. They did it out of conviction. And they did it also out of a desire for stylishness. I mean, they were very stylish indeed. Blunt was a very stylish man, very dry wit. One of the things that attracted me to him from the start was his wit. And in fact, I watched him on a few years ago, when I was starting the book, the BBC ran a program about Poussin, and largely to do with Blunt. And they had some television footage of him preparing for the press conference that he gave on the day that he was named. And I think he had it in that flat in the Courtauld Institute. And this was just film of him before the press conference started. And he was just sitting completely calm, watching the cameramen setting up their cameras and the reporters getting their notebooks ready. He was completely expressionless. But just once he glanced to the side, obviously not knowing there was a camera there already working, and this tiniest of smiles flitted across his face. And I could see him saying, these people think that they have me cornered and that they're going to humiliate me and they're going to get the goods out of me. They don't realize that I'm going to play with them. And of course, he proceeded to play with them in the most extraordinarily stylish and polished way.
Well, John,
that was something that attracted me to him.
You do a bit of stylish playing yourself. And this is in parenthesis. Why do you sink the slipper into Graham Greene with such pleasure? What is there about Greene that gets up your nose?
Yes, I feel that in the next book I'm going to have a character who's called Brown or White or Yellow or something, and he's going to have to be terribly nice and a lover of children and going about patting dogs on the head. I feel that I've been very bad to Green. I started out with this character, Quirrell, who I suppose has a lot of similarities to Green. But you see, the curious thing about fiction is that once a book gets going, even though you're writing about real people...
Oh, it has a life of its own. In other words, it wasn't your fault, John.
Yes, I know, but I know. This is a terribly weak excuse. But Quirrell just continued to get worse and worse as the book went on. And I kept feeling, I really should do something. I really should make him do something nice. And, of course, he is quite an authentic man, which is, I think, why Maskell absolutely hates him. But, of course, at the end, it's discovered that Quirrell is also somewhat ambiguous. But, no, I feel quite guilty about that, really.
Okay. I don't think you should. I don't think you should. You couldn't have treated Green any worse than some of his biographers have. I mean, one of the most recent ones is a real demolition job. And I think that even Philby, in the end, saw through Green's frequent visits to him, where he pretended to be an old colleague and friend returning to discuss the old days, when, of course, he was immediately reporting back to SIS when he returned to Britain, and was passing on from SIS to Filby offers for him to return to the UK.
Yes, and it does seem that Green used quite a lot of expenses from the SIS to travel all over the world. I don't think it was entirely disinterested. But at the same time, I don't think that Graham Greene was quite as horrible, quite as nasty a character as Mike Quirrell is.
Well, I shouldn't really have raised Graham Greene, but I just thought it was an immensely amusing part
of
the novel.
I mean, yes, but Greene is a fascinating character in the context that we're talking about, because there was a man who was a double, triple, quadruple, quintuple agent, if ever there was one. He was very much fascinated by these strange, cruel practical jokes that he played all the time. He led this double, triple life. I mean, he worked for the English British Civil Secret Service. I suspect he was also doing a little bit of work for the Russians as well. His championing of left-wing causes in the 50s, 60s, 70s, right up to his death, I think was extremely dubious as well. So he was a very interesting character. He was part of that circle.
Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia via ABC Online and Pod, a discussion about espionage with writers John Banville and Philip Knightley, and the former head of the foreign intelligence arm of the East German Stasi, Marcus Wolf, who died a couple of days ago. Marcus, let me read you a quote from your book. "A lifetime spent in intelligence is a mixture of glory in our occasional successes, misery when our best work is ignored, and the daily banality of working with any bureaucracy whose principal task often is delivering unwelcome news to its masters." Now, I know that as early as 81 you had misgivings about East Germany's future, but you weren't allowed to retire until 1986. Then around reunification, you receive a lot of anger from East Germany, from the East German population. You faced criminal trials. Was it all worth it?
No, I think not. You see, I meet on the streets, in the train, on the airport, a lot of people, and I never felt hatred. Of course, on some meetings, in some papers, there exists hatred and the feeling of persecution and revenge and so on, but the majority of I had a lot of meetings with the readers of my book. It's a big interest for such a life. What is that for a man who had such a life? And, of course, there's a lot of bad parts of this life. The results are bad. The state which we sought to build up as an alternative to the capitalist community disappeared. Of course, it's not a good balance of the life.
Well, Marcus, let's look from the macro to the micro. You masterminded the use of Casanova spies to prey on lonely West German women working in government, in bureaucracy. Looking back on this, do you feel any guilt or responsibility for the lives that must have been ruined by your Romeo spies?
Not, you may not generalize. Every case is another case. Every case is an individual case. And there are some of them, and I describe in my book, I have some to regret. But, of course, it was a part of the intelligence work during the Cold War. And every side, the Western and the Eastern, in the same way, used methods. You cannot judge by the normal moral standard in the normal life. But looking from now, I think I ask myself, and you found a part in my book, where was the sense? Was it necessary? Was the intelligence work in that time necessary? I think in the Cold War, yes, you may answer, but looking from now and thinking 10 years after my retirement, I ask this question, and I know Philip Knightley had the same question, a German, former West German intelligence chief, Admiral Schmeling, says there is no more sense for this work, who interrupts, who makes in the private life of a lot of people. There is no more sense. But my rational way of thinking says me again that the struggle of power continues, and so long as the government is interested to have any information in this struggle of power, intelligence services would exist, and their methods in future will not be very fine too.
Philip, I mentioned almost an hour ago when the program began that one of the growth areas in espionage is industrial espionage. Can you talk briefly to that as a growth industry?
Yes, I think what's happened with all these spy agencies, these bureaucracies, out of business because of the end of the Cold War, they've looked around for other things to do to justify their big budgets. And the first thing they did was to try to take away from other agencies the work that other agencies have been doing. Like the CIA said, we're now going to take over drug law enforcement. But then the DEA said, oh, no, you're not. That's our field. Over here, MI5 moved rapidly to tackle international crime syndicates, but Scotland Yard said, well, that's really our job. So they've been looking around for other things to do, and I think their next ploy will be to attempt to persuade governments that they can give them trade commercial information that will give those governments an edge in international negotiations, so that the CIA, the James Bond of the CIAs in the future might well spend a lot of time prowling Europe and Japan looking for new products, new patent applications, inside information about why the Japanese are so efficient at building cars, and passing that information on to the U.S. government, which in turn will pass it on to big American corporations to give them the edge in the international trade war.
I understand that in Australia very often some of our most efficient and useful spies have cover jobs with, say, a certain airline with a kangaroo in its tail, or some of the major mining companies, and they're working in Asia and Europe trying to work out what price coal can really get, command. I mean, it's pretty hard graft, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a tough, difficult world, much less glamorous, but maybe in the end more useful than it used to be being James Bond.
But there's none of that sort of idealism. I mean, you talked to Kim Philby in 88. He's accused of selling out to the Russians. But he asked, how come people like Alistair Cook are not accused of selling out to the Americans? Now, the Cambridge spies saw America as at least a bigger dangerous Nazi Germany, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, when Blunt was... Well, I'm now confused what I read in The Untouchable and what really happened. But I think Blunt was, if he didn't say it, then he should have, that he spied for a bigger church, than a larger church, a much different church than just spying for Soviet Russia, the Soviet Union. He was spying for the whole of Europe, and that they saw the prospects of Europe becoming an extension of the United States, both culturally and politically, is as big a danger to European independence as they did the threat of the Soviet Union.
John Banville, can you imagine circumstances in which you might have become a spy rather than a novelist?
Oh, absolutely. I think I would have loved to have been a spy. Certainly, if I could have had if I could have had the lifestyle that the Cambridge spies had. I mean, Blunt was an internationally honoured art historian. He was keeper of the Queen's pictures. He was quite well off. He lived a very stylish, well-heeled life.
John, I was hoping
had wonderful friends.
You've got some good friends too, John.
This is one of the great things that kept that circle together was their friendship. They were loyal to each other. They were extraordinarily loyal to each other.
I thought you were going to say something like you'd love to do something for Ireland. You'd like to sort of get into the Poms and do something for Ireland, and now you're telling me that you just would have lounged around in silk pyjamas.
Exactly. Yes, it's completely unserious, I'm afraid.
Look, I want to finish by asking Marcus to talk about the Bay of Pigs, because I think this offers testimony to his comment that Western democracies, like the East, don't always evaluate correctly the significance of intelligence. This is an interesting story, Marcus. What did Kennedy misread?
I think Kennedy was very new in his job as president when this adventure happened, and he had no experiences with intelligence service. I think if he would be a longer time president of the United States, he would be more careful to listen the advisors of such a service. And I think it's a misfortune of this big president that he had such bad advisors from the intelligence services.
Philip Knightley, we've been talking about spies for an hour, and we've been talking about men, blokes. No women in the profession of any significance?
Yes, a lot. They're very good at counterintelligence work for some reason or other. Probably the skill that they gather in detecting when their husband's lying, when he says where he's been in the evening. But Stella Rimington, for example, ran an MI5, a very high-powered position. There are lots of women serving officers with SIS. You need them because women comprise, I'm told, half the world. So, women are good spies. Their only drawback is they see it all as a rather wasteful little boy's game, more suitable to men than them, where they've got more serious things in the world to tackle.
That was Philip Knightley, journalist and author of many books on espionage, including a biography of Kim Philby, The Life and Views of a KGB Master Spy. Philip was joined in that discussion by John Banville, literary editor of the Irish Times and author of the splendid novel, The Untouchable, and also by Marcus Wolff, author of Man Without a Face, the autobiography of communism's greatest spy master. And that's it from us for the moment. I've got to go around the building and see if I can get into people's personal computers and find out what the hell's going on at the ABC. That's all from Classic LNL for another week. In that discussion on espionage, originally broadcast in July 1997, Philip Knightley, journalist and author of Philby, KGB Master Spy, published by André Deutsch, John Banville, author of The Untouchable, published by Vintage, and the late Marcus Wolff, former head of the foreign intelligence arm of East German Stasi, author of Man Without a Face, the autobiography of communism's greatest spy master, published by Public Affairs. We'll be back next week with another program from the archives. Meanwhile, stick around on ABC Radio National for the news, and we'll see you later.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.